This is Financial Standard, the definitive source of news, thought leadership and analysis for Australian wealth management professionals. Financial Standard, take the lead.
Hello and welcome back to the Financial Standard podcast. I'm Jamie Williamson, Managing Editor of Financial Standard and your host for today's episode, where we're going to dive into some recent research from Adelaide University and the SMSF Association on the performance of self-managed super funds and discuss some trends in the sector at large. To do that, I'm joined by SMSF Association Chief Executive Peter Burgess and Adelaide University Senior Lecturer in Finance, George Mihailov. Peter, George, thank you so much for jumping on the pod.
Thanks, Jeremy. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thank you for having me.
George, I want to come to you first because we are going to dive into this recent research. I'd really like it if we could kind of dig into, I guess, the methodology just to provide some context for the listeners. You were the project lead on the research. So if you could possibly just give us some detail as to what it was that I guess you were looking for.
Absolutely. Yeah. So we've been doing this research now for a number of years, covering a period of going back to 2017. And the research has really been structured around this core idea that we're going to try and replicate the methodology that APRA uses for APRA funds and apply that in the SMSF sector. So we're looking at fund level returns that are based on rates of return as calculated by APRA for APRA funds. Once we generate those returns at the level of individual funds, we then build our statistical analyses off of that data. So we use means and medians, and we summarize how the distribution looks each year that we investigate the performance of SMSFs. But really, it's designed for maximum comparability with the APRA sector.
And Peter, can you just touch on what the SMSF Association's role in the research is?
Yeah, look, we thought it was very important that we had research that can accurately compare the performance of the SMSF sector as a whole with the performance of the APRA fund sector. We were aware that the way returns are typically calculated for the SMSF sector, which is typically undertaken by the ATO every year, they use a different calculation methodology that is used for APRA funds. So, you know, we wanted to have some research out there where there was an accurate comparison of the two. So, you know, that was one of the drivers behind this research. As George has said, that we have been doing this research now for a number of years. I think this may be the fifth year in a row that we've produced these annual performance reports for the sector. And as I said, it's really to get a look at how the sector is performing as a whole when compared to the APRA fund sector.
Yeah.
So it's quite unique. I guess I would say it is unique in the way that it does its calculations. We're not aware of any other sort of research report like this that uses the same methodology. So you can get a real apples with apples comparison, if you like, because we're using the same calculation methodology.
And not maybe just to add one other thing that occurs to me, without getting too technical, we're supported by some really fantastic platform providers that have access to a really large number of funds. So that's a real strength for the research. So Class, BGL and Supermate, they all contribute data into this project. And the university basically, the team that I lead, we pull it all together and we're looking at any particular year, we're covering as many as 2/3 to 7 out of 10 SMSFs in Australia. So
yeah,
the sample sizes are really large.
Yeah, that's a really good point, George. And I should have mentioned that is a real advantage and real benefit of this research is just how the sample size itself, as George said, over 400,000 self-managed super funds, over 65% or around that percentage of the total SMSF population. So it's a massive sample of data that we're using here.
In terms of the actual research itself, and the big finding was obviously that SMSFs typically outperform APRA-regulated funds by about 1.1% over 5 years. George, do you have any insight as to what drives that?
Yeah, so I mean, our research has been varied over the years. We don't always replicate the exact same kind of subsequent analyses on the baseline performance figure. So I know that in the past we've looked at things like fund size and asset allocations. This latest version of our report doesn't examine those things directly, although I can comment based on our prior year findings.
Mm-hmm.
But generally, there's there is what we call a large minority of very, very, very well-performing SMSFs. So it's typically the top quartile, the top 25% of funds. They perform exceedingly better than all APRA funds. And it's really this cohort that explains these cumulative five-year results, because they end up basically disproportionately pulling the performance across the sector upwards. So typically we offer two major measures of performance aggregated across the sector. One is based on a median ROR. For your listeners, I suppose a median is basically the value that splits the bottom 50% from the top 50% of performing funds. And then we also have a second analysis based on mean RORs, which is just your typical average. But your typical average is not guaranteed to sit right in the middle of all the funds. So when we look at means, those really high-performing funds, they tend to pull the mean up a little bit. And that's really what contributes to this kind of sustained five-year performance figure that we release.
At the same time, though, the data does suggest that SMSFs tend to underperform APRA funds in times of strong market performance. Why is this?
Yeah, this is a brilliant question. This is one that Peter and I have been tackling for a few years, and certainly media and journalists always show an interest in this one. There are a couple of reasons that contribute to this. We tend to observe a higher proportion of defensive asset allocations in SMSFs than what you would ordinarily see in APRA funds. So there are these cohorts that tend to hold a little bit too much cash, a little bit too little international equities. And so when international markets are roaring and booming, the SMSF sector can be underexposed to that performance. But it's a double-edged sword, because it's precisely this that also helps protect them in downtimes. These defensive asset allocations, they tend to outperform APRA funds when there's a market downturn. So this is one of the things that contributes. There are other things. I mean, certainly fund size is something that's important. I know it's top of mind for Peter. There's probably maybe something around like one out of every 10 SMSFs that we think are maybe a little bit too small to have the scale, the size to generate the returns that they need to be competitive. Mm-hmm. And so certainly I know that the association is looking at this and thinking about how to appropriately manage it.
Yep, because I know at the recent conference, Peter, I do know that when you were discussing this research, you were saying that, you know, SMSFs aren't for everybody. And is that something that maybe it's not kind of known enough, or people just don't take seriously, maybe? Or it's hard to say.
Yeah, no, look, absolutely, SMSFs are not for everyone. And you know, you need to make sure that you understand your roles and responsibilities of being a trustee when you're taking on, you know, setting up a self-managed super fund and those things. I think what I would say is, and this comes out really clearly in this research, is the dispersion of returns that we see in the SMSF population and compared to what you see in the APRA fund world. And that's not a surprise when you think we're dealing with, well, in this research, 400,000 SMSFs. They all have their own investment strategy. They all have their own investment portfolio. So, you know, you would expect to see a much broader dispersion of returns compared to what you see in the APRA funds. But I think that dispersion really highlights the opportunity and the outperformance potential of self-managed super funds. But of course, it also highlights the risk associated if you don't have a proper strategy and you don't have that proper guidance. So, you know, really what we take away from this research is the benefits of professional advice, making sure that you're in that top tail, not the bottom end of that tail, because as we said, we can see some SMSFs perform extremely strongly. And that's attractive to the aspirational members out there that want to try and achieve higher returns. This research really shows the opportunity, as I said, that SMSFs can present. But of course, it also shows the risk of underperformance if you're not taking it, taking appropriate steps and seeking advice and have a proper strategy.
I do want to dive a little bit deeper into the disparity of returns that you've uncovered in the research. So the data shows that it is significant. So the top 25% of SMSFs perform way better than the bottom 25%, to put it bluntly. In terms of why this is, we've kind of already touched on some of the factors that could be contributing, but is there any trends that you can kind of identify? Is it asset allocation? Is it balance size? Are the top 25% the ones that do receive advice? Like, is there any kind of indication at all available?
It's all of the above. So okay. Every single one of these things is contributing some proportion of explaining the performance differential. In this latest edition of the research, we didn't look at comparing advised versus non-advised funds. And I think it's probably also important to note that we get data on an anonymized basis, so we're okay. never able to identify who the trustees are or what their specific patterns of behavior and management style are. We observe merely the financials. But a couple of years ago, we did look at comparing advised versus non-advised funds, and we were able to find a performance differential between those two cohorts as well. So advised funds were in the minority. I think, I can't remember the exact figure, but it's somewhere around 15 to 20% of funds are receiving advice uh-huh. versus 80 to 85% are not. And there was about a 1% performance edge to funds that are receiving advice. So certainly that, you know, that contributes explaining that differential between the top 25% and the bottom 25% to some extent. The asset allocations we mentioned earlier, fund size, all of these things play a role.
Peter, I might come to you just now with another thing that I picked up at the recent conference that the SMSF Association had, which was one of the presenters talked about the increase in people using SMSFs without an advisor or establishing an SMSF without an advisor. I think only 20% of the SMSFs that were recently established had been done so with the help of a financial advisor. The speaker was saying that most SMSFs are mature enough to make their own investment decisions. Would you agree with that? And do you think that the data actually supports that?
Yes, look, it certainly seems to be the case that the majority of SMSFs being established today are being done so without the benefit of financial advice. We've seen some statistics from the ATO and also more recently, and some of those statistics that were presented at our national conference from CLASS seem to support that around 80% of new SMSFs being established today are being done so without financial advice. Now, you know, we are, as an association, very pro-advice. We believe people achieve better outcomes when they do receive professional advice. So we certainly encourage people when they're considering an SMSF to seek professional advice before making that step. But I think it would be wrong, and we've learned this lesson over the years, to just to assume that because they haven't received advice that they're uninformed. Uh-huh. Certainly, from what we can see, they are very informed, or at least many of these SMSF trustees that are setting up SMSFs are very informed. So I don't think we should automatically jump to the conclusion that just because they haven't received financial advice that they are not informed. And you would expect them to do their own research and to make an informed decision. After all, we're talking about their own money. So I think we've learned that lesson over the years, that don't just assume that they're uninformed. We know that, you know, running an SMSF, it can be complex at times, and during the life cycle of an SMSF, we see a lot of these people turning to advice when it suits them. So they maybe not be seeking this advice at establishment stage. It doesn't mean that they won't seek financial advice at some point during their journey, and certainly from what we can see, they typically do.
Yeah.
When we looked at funds receiving advice, it was an approximate measure based on whether or not they pay advice fees. That's the way that we observe whether or not a fund is likely receiving advice. One of the really interesting findings to come out of that version of our research, I think it was the third iteration of it, Peter, I can't remember, is that advice is much more important for helping lift the floor of low-performing funds rather than for raising the ceiling of high-performing funds. So if a fund is already generating above-average returns and doing really well, financial advice was uncorrelated with improved levels of performance for those funds. But for funds that were maybe smaller, that did have a concentrated asset allocation, holding too much cash, it's those funds that stand to benefit the most from receiving financial advice.
Yeah, wow. Is that also because there is so many, well, not so many, but there is many SMSFs that are perhaps only holding one, two, three assets in the way of property, or possibly like they're just very concentrated in terms of what the actual investments are? And so then it's kind of that benefit of diversification?
Partly, yes, but not so much because there's so many such funds, but rather because sound financial management principles are relatively, they're basic, right? I mean, diversification is not a complex concept. It, you know, don't have all your eggs in one basket. And So really, if trustees understand several sort of basic tenets of financial management and investment management, that would be enough in most cases to get them being, you know, managing very competitive funds and potentially even very outperforming funds.
Uh-huh.
So it's really financial advice adds the most value when you get someone to stop holding 80% cash and 20% equities rather than getting someone to buy Telstra shares instead of BHP shares.
Yeah. Okay.
Who already has a balanced asset allocation.
In terms of asset allocation, I want to kind of pivot a little bit. We've established that part of SMSF's resilience is that they do kind of possibly sometimes skew a bit more conservative in their allocations. There's obviously been a lot of uncertainty in the world and in markets in recent years. And I mean, obviously now geopolitical factors are a huge consideration for investors. Peter, do you think that this kind of demonstrated resilience of SMSFs over the longer term is in some way behind those increased establishments that we've seen? I think the most recent data was September 2025, that quarter. There was about 14,500 new SMSFs established, which is significant.
Yeah, look, it is. And, that's off the back of 42,000 new funds being established in the last financial year. So, we're on track to set a new record number of SMSF establishments in this financial year. And that itself is interesting because it would then be the third year in succession where we've had, almost record numbers and potentially a record number in this financial year. So, but that's unusual. We don't typically see year on year growth in establishment numbers like this. It tends to bounce around from one year to the next. So, you know, that suggests to me that there is a structural change underway out there where we're seeing more superannuation members looking to be more engaged with their superannuation and take more control and looking for more tailored outcomes. I think to your question around volatility, it's not unusual in periods of volatility, uncertainty in the markets to see people wanting to take more control and to bring things closer to home. So we know that that is a factor. Possibly is a factor behind some of this growth, but there are many other factors that are driving this growth of SMSF establishments. We know it is easier today to set up an SMSF than perhaps it's ever been, and access to information, people are feeling more empowered in order to be able to make their decisions. So there's lots of different factors coming into it, and no doubt uncertainty and that volatility is one of those factors.
I want to touch on something that obviously everybody's been talking about lately. Now we know that it's definitely coming as well, Division 296, the super tax. If there is a link between performance and balance size, do you envision that the tax is going to have an impact on SMSF's performance at all in terms of the research that you guys do? If SMSF members decide to start, I guess, not contributing as much to their SMSFs, or they kind of reevaluate what their strategies are going to be to keep the size of the actual SMSF down, do you envision there being an impact on performance long term?
I think if we look at the research we've done in prior years where I know George did some work around the level at which an SMSF becomes, reaches scale, I guess, from an investment return point of view. And, you know, from memory, it was down around that $200,000 mark that a fund actually becomes competitive from an investment return. It reaches scale essentially at that level. So looking at that figure, you wouldn't say that the fact that we've got this tax coming in at the $3 million mark, on face value, I don't see it having an impact, certainly on the research performance or the reports that we produce every year. But George, I'll pass to you. You might have a different view.
No, not at all. I very much agree with what you just said. And really, we would expect Division 296 to probably have an impact for a very small minority of funds. I shouldn't say very small minority, but it will be a minority of funds that are typically at the upper tail of the distribution. Uh-huh. So maybe a fund that would previously be earning 15% per annum now might be earning 14% per annum after Division 296 or something like this. We did do a tax analysis for the association a couple of years ago when the tax was originally proposed. That analysis was based on the original version of the tax before it was revised by the government. And I'm actually hopeful that our analysis helped with that revision, because we were quite, I remember being quite stunned seeing that they were proposing to tax unrealized gains and the implications that that would have for funds in terms of some of them having to sell assets in order to cover their tax liability. So in its latest form, where this is sort of being corrected and they've introduced these, they're indexing the thresholds and it's gone from just 3 million to 3 and 10 million. I think each of these things is potentially an improvement in the way that the tax is structured. And so really then it becomes an empirical question. We'll be able to compare our data pre-296 and post-296, and we'll be able to see when we do those analyses in a few years' time, hopefully, the level of impact that it's had on performance.
Yeah, it would be very interesting to see.
Yeah, I was just going to add to that. I think we're in a much better position with the revised approach to this tax than what we were with the original version. As George said, the original version was intended to tax unrealized capital gains. And, you know, if that had come in that format, we would have seen some pretty erratic, unconventional behavior from investors. And it may well have had an impact on the overall sector performance, because, you know, we were looking at a situation where funds were probably going to have to hold more cash because of the need to fund tax on an unrealized gain. So all of those things would have led to some, you know, pretty unconventional behavior, I would have thought. But fortunately, and I think George has been very modest in the research that he did around the impact of taxing unrealized capital gains. And the effect that had on the government's decision to revise this. So it was a great piece of research, and we're very thankful that the university was able to do that.
And obviously, I mean, Division 296 has also been kind of positioned as a real opportunity for financial advisors from a business perspective. But if we're seeing this kind of trend in establishments that aren't attached to an advisor, do you think that Division 296, given its complexity, do you think that it's likely that maybe some of those SMSFs are going to move towards an advised model? They're going to be seeking a financial advisor to help them with this? Or do we think that maybe they're some of those SMSFs that George was mentioning that probably won't really be impacted too much?
Yeah, it's a really good observation. Division 296 is a very, very complex tax. So it is going to be very difficult for clients to understand this, for consumers to understand how this tax is going to work, whether it's going to impact them or not. So we would expect that they will be seeking advice to understand, you know, the implications. If you think of things like the way the CGT rules will work, so they are, the legislation will exclude gains which have accrued before the start of this tax from the calculation of earnings for Division 296, but that requires funds to make an election to have that relief applied to them. And so that will apply, you know, people that are not over 3 million today, that may at some time in the future, they'll need to consider whether they should make that election because there is a time frame associated with that election. So it affects a lot more people than just those that are just over the $3 million cap. But as I said, it is a very complicated tax. So we would envisage that people will be turning to financial advice to understand how it works and what it means for them.
Finally, I just want to say, like, there's obviously a lot happening in the SMSF space. There kind of always is. There has been for a few years now. But now that this Division 296 has become a reality and there's a few other kind of regulatory factors on the horizon as well, with all of the stuff that's going on in the current market environment, what would you kind of predict is sort of the outlook for the SMSF sector? Peter, I might come to you first.
Oh, look, I think we'll continue to see the sector grow and grow quite strongly. We think in terms of the total assets, we will see as a percentage of total superannuation assets, the SMSF sector probably coming down over the next decade. And that's because a lot of these mega funds, as we call them, these very large self-managed super funds with very large balances will be washed out of the system as those members move on, and they can't be replenished with, you can't make those contributions back into the fund because we've got, you know, contribution caps. So I think as a percentage of overall fund, we will see SMSFs come down, but the number of people holding self-managed super funds, we expect will continue to grow very strongly.
George, any insights at all?
I can only share my own experience. Every year that we release our performance research, I get an enormous amount of media outreach, SMSF professionals, advisors emailing me asking for copies of the report, trustees from upper North Queensland sending me an email saying, I saw this in the news. And so every year we release this research, I know that we generate a lot of interest across a variety of different stakeholders. And I just really, thank you to Peter and to the association for the work that they do in representing the sector. There's a lot of policy and a lot of advocacy that goes into that, but it's a very diverse sector, and it reads this. It requires this kind of folks to coalesce around an entity, and the association really does a very good job of representing everyone's diverse interests as best as they possibly can. And the university is just an ally in that way, kind of supporting this work and advocating for the sector. I'm very happy to be involved with it.
Well, thank you so much. We're very happy to have both of you involved in the pod today. So thank you for taking the time once again, Peter and George.
Pleasure, Jamie.
Absolute pleasure.
And thank you to our listeners as well. We look forward to seeing you next time.
Thanks for listening to this Financial Standard podcast. For more information, visit financialstandard.com.au. Please keep in mind that the information discussed in this podcast is general in nature and does not consider personal circumstances. Reliance should not be placed on any content without further independent financial research and advice.